today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
And so there was David Byrne. I got to like, Mr. Byrne. And he turned and he came to me. And it was funny. He was wearing the white suit, not the big white suit. That would have been too classic.
All right. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is Thursday here on Story Song Week. Of course, Story Song Week has taken over the country, and I think many shops are closed in observance. But here on Rockin' the Suburbs, of course, it's even extra special because we have my longtime friend Steve Hawkinsmith here with us. I'm Jim Linehan, and hello, Steve.
Well, hey, Jim. How's it going today?
It's going great. You enjoying?
You had a good night's sleep last night. You're rested.
Oh, yeah.
You're ready
all rested,
for more.
Ready to go. I had some juice. I'm all set.
All right, as long as we're juiced up.
Yeah. Now, how's Story Song Week been for you so far?
Oh, I've been loving it. I mean, it's been really a fun experience to get caught up, of course, and chat with you, but also to like kind of get this fun homework beforehand of like, you know, here's all these songs that you haven't heard. Because I will say, of the songs that were recommended by others, I don't think I knew any of them.
Oh, okay.
I knew the artists, but yeah, like and I might have known of a few of the songs. No, I don't even think so. I think they were all new songs to me. They were all good, and they all, you know, just opened up new avenues of musical exploration that I didn't even know existed before.
It's interesting. Now, I will say, yes, listeners, we do prepare. I do prep work before this podcast. You may not believe it, but it does happen. However, this one, I really had to prepare a lot because you're talking story songs, man. You really have to pay attention to the lyrics. It's a little different than when, you know, I could just say like, oh, that guitar sound was cool. You know, I can't do that so much here. I gotta come at it with a little bit deeper exploration than that.
Yeah, no, I am somebody who always listens to the lyrics or always tries to, probably always like half misunderstands them a lot of the time. But no, I'm always listening. But yeah, you're so right. I had to listen more deeply, which meant listening multiple times. And then for several of them, go to Google and find the lyrics
right.
And read them to figure out what I was missing.
Okay, now, Steve Hawkinsmith, published novelist. I have a couple of quick questions for you before we get into the story song picks. First off, this is something I meant to ask you yesterday and I forgot. You've written a number of series mm-hmm. of books. And of course, as we discussed, I guess it would be the main one is Homes on the Range, right? With mm-hmm. Old Red and Big Red.
And, very good. Yes, indeed.
Yes. And I wonder, as an author, as someone who writes fiction, after you write that, well, let me back up a second. Did you conceive of Homes on the Range as being a series from the beginning before you know, while you were writing the first book, or when you get done with the first one, do you think like, I can't let go of these characters. I want to continue to, you know, to explore this world that I've created. I mean, what is the, I guess, sort of the thought process there as opposed to yeah. turning to creating whole new characters, right. And going a different direction with, you know, other stories to tell.
Yeah, no, with those, I knew pretty much from the beginning that it had a ton of series potential, but I didn't know if it would be a series. But I created the characters for a short story. They originally appeared in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. And the reason that I wrote it for Ellery Queen was that Ellery Queen every year will do a Sherlock Holmes tribute issue. And I was writing for Ellery Queen at the time, you know, but it's always a crapshoot, you know, when you're writing for a fiction magazine, they might buy the story, they might not. So you're always trying to like figure out, you know, what will give me an edge, what you're writing the best story possible. But, you know, you want to try to play the angles and like, what are they looking for? So like, oh, they do a Sherlock Holmes tribute issue. I should write a Sherlock Holmes story. Or a Sherlockian story, I should say, because I didn't want to write a Sherlock Holmes story. I did not want to write a story about Sherlock Holmes. I just felt like I'm not English. I wasn't alive in the Victorian era. I don't trust myself to capture that voice. So the voice that I do feel like I can capture would be an American voice, even an American voice from the Victorian era, which the cowboys of the Old West were. People sort of forget that, but that was all, there was all crossing over and happening at the same time. So that's how I sort of created Big Red and Old Red, the cowboys who stumble upon the stories about Sherlock Holmes and try to do it themselves so that I could write it from an American perspective in an American setting. And then once I had that first story sold to Ellery Queen, it worked, they bought it. Then I was like, well, I guess I got to write another, right? And they bought it. And, you know, it was after I'd sold them three or four stories and I was looking around for an idea for a novel that I was like, well, I guess I should give these guys a try in a book and we'll see if they drive me crazy, you know, in the year it takes to write a novel. And they didn't, thank goodness. And then it was off to the races from there.
Wow. As an author, what is your connection with the characters? I mean, these are characters you created and you give voice to and you direct their actions and so on. But is there like a, in some weird way, kind of a distance there too, where you see them as, you know, kind of people in your lives in some way?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. And it is something that I will, I won't say struggle with, but there are times it's harder to pull off than other times. So, you know, there's the two brothers, Big Red, Old Red. Big Red's the younger one, and he's the sort of gregarious, talkative one, the people person one. And then you've got Old Red, the older one, who's actually the brilliant detective of the two, but is illiterate, and is an introvert and, you know, a little bit crabby. And the thing about them is they're both me. They're both sides of me. Like, I can turn on the gregarious, talkative, you know, side at a party and keep that going for a good, you know, 91 minutes. And then I will burn out and I need to go home and I need to be Old Red and I need to like leave me alone. I just know to sit and you know, have my thoughts and I can't do this anymore. So they're both sides of me, but I find that when I'm writing, the Holmes on the Range stuff, it's all from Big Red's perspective. He's the narrator. Mm-hmm. I never struggle to figure out what Big Red is thinking or feeling. Like I always am very in touch with like, this is how Big Red would react. Cause he's not a simple guy. You know, he has depth, but he's just more predictable to me. And he's a guy who always will try to find the humor in something. And so that's easy for me to access. And if there's ever a time where, I have to sort of dig in deeper to Old Red and figure out how is he reacting to this, you know, more complicated emotional reality. He's harder. And there are, and again, because I'm telling the whole story from Big Red's perspective, I'm always in it. And there are times, you know, where Big Red's wondering what Old Red's thinking and where Big Red doesn't always know why Old Red does this or that or the other
right.
thing. And there are times I have to think really, really hard about like, why is Old Red doing this? Or what would Old Red do? How would he react in this situation? What is his internal life? And I always get there, but I have to do more work sometimes.
Interesting. So there's a little bit of distance between you and that character. That's an interesting
between
thing.
Me and Old
right,
Red.
But I can see
exactly how he would want it.
Right, right. But I can
he doesn't want anybody too close.
That's right. Now, one more thing before we get into the story song picks that I wanted to bring up. Earlier in the week, we talked about the fact that we were both journalism students. Or worked at the school paper at Indiana University. I don't know if you actually, did you major in journalism? Were you an English major or?
I was a double major, journalism and history.
Okay, got it. So we worked at the school paper and went on to writing careers and so on. But as I recall, and I remember being impressed by this, I think it was an internship you had with People Magazine. Am I remembering this correctly?
That was the summer of 1989, and you are remembering it correctly.
I thought it was so cool because most of us got internships at just like local papers, you know, throughout the country. And, you know, in some cases, you know, maybe a few people would get on at like metro papers, you know, big city newspapers. And then, you know, others like myself, you know, smaller communities. But man, it was like People Magazine. That's huge, right? So
it was huge.
What was that like?
Oh, it was mostly a ton of fun. I mean, it was through the American Society of Magazine Editors, if I'm remembering right. And so like they have this program where college students, you know, get to apply and they have like 50, I don't even know if they still do it, but they did in the late 80s, where, you know, college students from all over the country apply for like these 50 slots at Fortune, Money, Time, People, Reader's Digest, Sports Illustrated, like any mm-hmm. of the big magazines of the day, they were part of this program. And if you got in, then you got to go to New York for the summer and live in an NYU dorm and take the subway to whichever office you're going to. And mine was in the Time Life building. I mean, it was like pretty dang cool. So it was mostly a great experience. I got to go to a couple movie premieres in New York, which was really neat. Not the greatest movies. Great Balls of Fire was coming out.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
So, yes, I got to be part of the team that covered Great Balls of Fire for People magazine. And I was super excited, not because I was a huge Jerry Lee Lewis fan, but because I found out that David Byrne was going to be there. And as we mentioned in an earlier episode this week, Talking Heads, one of my favorite bands of all time, just absolutely love them to death. And so I got to go to the swanky premiere, and they kept all the journalists kind of corralled, literally a corral, a velvet rope corral, this little area where you could stand and then try to attract the attention of celebrities who were scoring their free drinks out in the rest of the club. And so there was David Byrne. I got to like, Mr. Byrne. And he turned and he came and he came to me. And it was funny. He was wearing the white suit, not the big white suit. That would have been too classic. But it was an actual form-fitting version of the white suit. And he looked like David Byrne. And he came over. And I was like, what do I ask David Byrne? And it has to be, I'm trying to get a quote for People magazine. It has to be something related to this movie or Jerry Lee Lewis. So I asked him, Mr. Byrne, would you call Jerry Lee Lewis an influence on you in any way? And of course, the answer is like no. But I don't know. This is the best I can come up with.
That's a reasonable question. Yeah,
it's a reasonable question. And so I just remember his response was to sort of pause, look at the ceiling, say, "Well, he's one of the Pantheon." And then he looks past my shoulder and says, "Excuse me," and walks away. And that was my David Byrne moment. I got to meet him.
That's great. That is fantastic. All right. So on the topic of music, let's get to story songs for today. Let's see. We're going to start here with somebody who's of that same era of Talking Heads. Right. So what is your choice today?
Yes, this would be Hidden Shame by Elvis Costello. I mean, anybody who's been following us along this week, knowing, as I'm sure everyone does now, that they've all got to know me so well, knowing that I am a huge Madness fan, a huge Squeeze fan, would not be shocked to hear that I have a great deal of respect for Mr. Elvis Costello. This was actually Hidden Shame, a song that came out not in this heyday. This is from the 21st century. Actually, but you know, obviously, when you look at people who are sort of respected songwriters to grow out of, you could call it new wave or whatever, to grow out of that era of English pop rock, Elvis Costello is right up there. But the thing about Elvis, there's many things about Elvis, but one of the things about Elvis is pretty soon in his career, it wasn't maybe so much at the forefront for his first whatever four or five albums, but Americana is absolutely something that he loves and knows well.
Yeah.
And it's something that he has returned to again and again throughout his career with his songwriting. And in fact, there is a song that that he co-wrote with Paul McCartney called That Day Is Done, which I had become familiar with years ago. I didn't even know at the time when I first heard it. I heard it as like a live version. I did not know that it was co-written with Paul McCartney, but it's sort of a revisiting of a classic American trope, which is the death song. the I murdered somebody and now I've got to pay song.
Right.
And you know, that could go all the way back to like Streets of Laredo.
The murder ballad.
The murder ballad. Actually, that's exactly it.
Yep.
Long Black Veil,
yep.
Lefty Frizzell would be like, you know, as it's coming into the modern age. And so That Day Is Done is, you know, sort of from the perspective of someone who's been in a situation in which people died, and is sort of reflecting on the woman sort of left behind. And in that particular song, he's doing it from his grave. It's a wonderful song. I don't really like Paul McCartney actually recorded that. I learned today. Don't love his version, much as I love Mr. McCartney. But Elvis recorded a version with a gospel group that you can find on YouTube, the Fairfield Four. And boy, do I love that version of the song. It's very spooky and ethereal and moody. So he'd already done this once, that he had sort of returned to the murder song as a trope. Well, here in Hidden Shame, he did it again. And there's many things I really like about this song, but one thing I really like about it is that it's returning to this trope of, here's a first person narrator telling you about this sort of tale of woe, right? I got mixed up in this horrible situation and somebody died and now I have to pay the price. I Hung My Head by Johnny Cash, very much in that same vein, a song that I never knew, but wonderful song that you had recommended,
yes.
The Sting cover, which I thought was
Well, it's actually
fantastic.
The other way around, but I'll get to that in a moment.
I want to hear about that.
Go ahead.
Okay,
keep going.
But that song is very much that kind of song. So Hidden Shame, it's returning to that kind of song, but now there's a modern twist because the song is talking about it. It's talking about something that I think you might say, if we could, you know, Freudianize a lot of the previous songs, might have been in there, but it couldn't be talked about because the song is actually about internalized homophobia. It's about a guy who ended up killing the love of his life, or at least a love, because of the self-hatred that he felt. And again, it's sort of implied, but you get that it's there, that he can't deal with the hidden shame. He can't deal with the thing because you can tell, like, obviously this takes place in the past. Sometimes you don't know if it's the 1890s or the 1920s or what it is, but it's sometime in the past when this was not spoken of. And he has this friend of his, this special friend, and they go off into the woods and they have a moment and something happens and the guy snaps. And then he comes down and he has a sort of PTSD. Like, he comes down the mountain, he can't even really remember what happened, but his friend is dead. And he sort of, he knows, but he doesn't know. And it's like about denial and self-hatred.
I'm sorry to say that you don't know me. In many ways you never understood. Each time I try to tell an ugly truth, you always let it pass you by. You said I'd never tell you a lie just because I could. Do you really think I was a bad man? You always said that should be my middle name. Well, you don't know the half of it. You don't know how that name fits. You don't know my hidden shame. Hidden shame, shame, shame. And I can't get free from the blame and the torture and the misery. Is it being my secret or eternity? Do you know my hidden shame? Really don't know. Have to look much like a cell. It's already on your mind, boy. We can see it in your eyes. So here's the bars and the walls as well. Well, you know I'm never coming home to you. You'll soon stand by me until I clear my name. Sure, it's easy to be strong when you know the charge is wrong. But the days and weeks get long when you got it.
So it's really addressing something that, like, Lefty Frizzell is not going to be able to sing about this subject.
Right.
But Elvis, you know, from the 21st century perspective, he could look back and say, let's take that kind of song and let's get some modern psychology in it. And you get this. And so not only is it, are the lyrics super well written,
yeah,
and interesting in that Elvis way, I think as sort of like, you know, it's produced by T-Bone Burnett as sort of a rootsy country song. I also think it slaps.
Totally agree.
So catchy. Yeah.
Totally agree.
Great song.
It's layered. It has a lot of layers to this song. And so, again, it tells a story, but it's not a one listen kind of story. You want to go over this one, you know, a few times to really get it, I think.
Yeah. And even then, you know, ambiguity, we've said, is something we've tried to stay away from. There is some ambiguity in the song. In the end, and this is where, like, maybe my brain doesn't work right, I think it's unclear why he's in jail at this time. He's in jail for something, and he's speaking to a woman who's waiting for him,
right,
who has faith in him, and he's saying, like, well, if you only really knew,
right,
maybe you wouldn't have faith in me. But we don't know. They say they locked me up here for the ideas in my head. They never got me for the thing I really did.
Right.
Well,
right.
What's the ideas in my head? What are you in jail for? Are you like a labor organizer, or what is it exactly? We don't know, but we do know he can never forgive himself. He will always be in a jail because he will never forgive himself for this thing he did do.
Is it a jail like criminal, or is it like a psycho ward kind of thing? Is he in some mental hospital, right?
That would make a ton of sense, because here's a guy who's obviously tortured by his past. That makes a ton of sense. If he's like, you're right, he's not in jail. He's been institutionalized.
Right.
I think you're absolutely right.
It could be. I mean, but again, there's some level of interpretation in this song. Your mind can go in some different directions to it. The ambiguity is part of it, I think, intentionally so. But yet still, you get a satisfying story out of it, you know.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, you could say, like, I who through the course of the week keep saying, like, well, I don't know if that's a story song, that's a character song. This is a character song, very strongly a character song, but there is enough of a narrative, I think, with a twist that we learn in the sort of, you know, that one chorus that that makes the rest of the song come into focus and the theme of the song come into focus. So it's a reveal that's a narrative reveal. That's part of a story. So I think that's enough there to say that it has a story structure.
Right. Right. Now you mentioned the song, I Hung My Head, which I had sent that to you as one of the songs I might pick. And I ended up, you know, not going with it because we got so many great listener calls that, you know, people hear me enough. They don't need to hear more of me. But anyway, but I'll just mention it here real quickly here, because there's a tie here to this song, which is, I heard the song I Hung My Head on one of the Johnny Cash American Recordings albums, and I was blown away by the song. I just thought it was a fantastic song. And, you know, it's a story song, and it's just really like somber and just kind of punches you in the gut, you know, kind of thing. Right. And so anyway, but I was surprised to learn that the songwriter, because I just would never have expected this would come out of him, was Sting.
Oh, Sting wrote it and Johnny Cash covered it.
Yes.
Oh, that's hilarious. Because I, of course, thought it was the other way around.
Right.
So hats off to Sting. Right. More hats have come off, and this time to Sting.
Yeah. It's not at all what I would have expected. Not that type of song to come from Sting.
Well, you know, because to talk about sort of an Englishman who loves Americana, you know, it's a song. It could almost feel like a cowboy story, right? It feels like rural America, of someone who goes out with his rifle and just kind of, or goes out with his brother's rifle, just kind of messing around with it and shoots a guy, and then has to deal with the price of it. Seems so much like a Johnny Cash song. Seems so much like an American song. So a la Elvis Costello with Hidden Shame and That Day Is Done, there was Sting paying, you know, also obviously another guy who has a lot of appreciation for Americana.
So my connection here is that when I was looking up Hidden Shame, that Johnny Cash recorded that song as well.
Yes.
And apparently first, amazing. Right? So even though Elvis Costello wrote it, the Johnny Cash recording came out in like 1990.
Oh, so what? Yeah. See, I'm learning new things today. This is beautiful. Yes. I did not know the song was that old. I did not know that Johnny Cash recorded it first. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. I kept trying to making sure I was, you know, double and triple and checking this and making sure it was correct. But it appears that Elvis must have written it for Johnny Cash or somehow got it to Johnny Cash or whatever, maybe through Nick Lowe, who had a connection. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But the Johnny Cash version came out in 1990, which was not necessarily a great period in Johnny Cash's popularity. So maybe that's partly why maybe it's sort of been overlooked. But then much later, 2009 was when Elvis released his own version of the song. Yeah.
That's so funny. So I will now remove my hat again. I am removing it for Johnny Cash, someone that we had to talk about this week, because he did so many songs that were wonderful story songs. And, you know, I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before when we were talking about the Rod Stewart song, Death of Georgie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, giving him props for doing that song in the 1970s. Well, let's give it up for Mr. Cash,
right,
for even in 1990 doing this song, which so clearly is a song from the perspective of a repressed gay guy.
Right.
That would not have gone down well with, you know, a certain segment of the traditional Johnny Cash audience.
That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, he recognized that, like, Elvis Costello wrote him a cool song and he did it. Like,
yeah.
Johnny, you rock.
Yeah, that's awesome. And we also should mention, when you and I were talking about this topic of story songs, of course, one of the all-time great story songs that has, you know, top of mind, people will point to right away and satisfies the passes the Hawkinsmith test. The Hawkins test is A Boy Named Sue, right?
Yes, which is it's funny. That is a song that I knew the existence of, but I didn't give it a listen until this week. So, you know, again, your homework assignments are going to pay off for me for a lifetime. And I listened to that song, and what a funny and amazing story it is that absolutely comes to a couple of great payoffs at the end. And you and I had some back and forth about it. It was like, yeah, that song is so great. Boy, that Johnny Cash. And you just happened to mention in passing that it was written by Shel Silverstein. And I was like, what? Yeah. Mind blown again. And yet, in hindsight, it made such total sense because it has that sense of sort of absurdity to it and humor that just absolutely puts it in the Shel Silverstein wheelhouse. And again, Johnny Cash recording a Shel Silverstein song. I you gotta love that.
Right.
And it's a great song.
It is. It's great. So, okay, enough about us. Let's turn to the listeners here. So, speaking of, you know, classic story songs, we get one here from Jason Goebel. Not the song, the recommendation.
Hey, Jim and Pat, Jason Goebel. Figured I'd answer the call for story songs. And my pick, and admittedly, it's a long song, but it is my favorite story song, so I'm going with it. It's Alice's Restaurant by Arlo Guthrie. I guess two reasons why I love this song. First, it always reminds me of Thanksgiving. I don't know how local radio was wherever you or most of the listeners were. In New York, we had a classic rock station that always on Thanksgiving would bust out Alice's Restaurant a couple times a day. For me, I would be in transit either by train or waiting for a train to go to wherever I was celebrating Thanksgiving, and I'd have my Walkman with me and be listening to Alice's Restaurant as I was traveling to my destination. So, you know, always brings up great memories of Thanksgiving. So that's the first reason. The second, and admittedly, you have to be in the mood to listen to this song. So it's a song I really don't listen to much, mostly around as Thanksgiving is coming. And that's probably part of the reason why I say what I'm about to say, which is, to me, I think the sense of humor about the song still holds up every time I listen to it. It starts with the absurdity of the crime, which was littering in a ravine where garbage was not supposed to be dumped, and the major deal that police officer Obi makes of the crime at the end of the day, always sticks in my mind about the 8x10 glossies with all sorts of arrows and explanations on the back, explaining about the littering, to the fact that, he talks about the fact that, he seemed to be a candidate ideal for getting drafted to go to Vietnam, and, got denied entrance just because he littered in a ravine at the end of the day. To even the end of the song, when he's trying to encourage the audience to sing the chorus, and he comes up with the line, "I've been singing this song for 20 minutes. I can sing it for 20 minutes more," and says under his breath, "I'm not proud." For all those reasons, as I said, I just find the song funny, and again, every time I listen, I definitely am chuckling. So for those reasons, I am a big fan of Alice's Restaurant, and hope you included whatever you're doing in terms of the stories, songs, shows you're gonna, I guess, be doing. Thanks again. Hope all is well with you too and with the rest of the community, and speak to you all later.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant, she lives in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road. And off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile is better than two little piles, and rather than bring that...
Now, the one thing I want to ask you, Steve, about this is, different than many other story songs, or even most songs, is it's written more in like prose than verse, right?
And yeah, it's spoken. mostly. It's basically right. a spoken word thing with sort of a groove, you could call it, you know, sort of a country homey groove going on in the background. So to me, it feels very much like a monologue.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That's cool. It works. You know, you've got, I don't know to what degree this is true to Arlo Guthrie, but certainly there is a character, there's a personality who is speaking directly to you and relating to you first, you know, like a sort of a series of wacky experiences and then sort of thoughts about that and where that could go. So it feels extremely direct. And we've talked about, you know, the appreciation we have when looking at story songs this week for clarity and directness. And this absolutely has that. It's a hippie guy talking to you, and you listen to the hippie guy talk to you for 10 minutes, tells you this amusing story, and then he's got some thoughts about it. You just felt like you spent 10 minutes with the guy.
Right, exactly. That came out in 1967, and it very much feels of its time. I'll say that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, yeah, no, it couldn't have been written at any other time. I mean, it is so much about the concerns of the day, and more than that, even it's sort of, I won't say the style of the day because it's very unique, but the way that he looks at things, the way he's talking about things, the kind of story he's telling, it is very, very much a late 60s counterculture narrative.
Totally, totally. I'm sure it killed back then.
I'm sure.
Okay. One more call here today. This is from Peter Nordgren.
Hi, it's Peter Nordgren in beautiful Cornucopia, Wisconsin, where we just had the big Bayfield Apple Festival, and now the word of the week is, hey, it's not snowing yet. Story songs. Boy, that certainly stimulated my thinking. My 7-year-old granddaughter, Ida, says that her current favorite song is That Was a Crazy Game of Poker by OAR. I've looked at the lyrics of that one, and I have to agree that is a story song worthy of academic study. So I think that's the story song that I'll recommend to you. Enjoy the stories. I'm Peter Nordgren in Cornucopia. Keep on rocking the suburbs. Bye for now.
Okay, and nice to hear that Peter's getting recommendations from, I think he said his granddaughter. So, yeah, good. Nice. There.
Getting the youth in here. That's why not? Right. But, Jim, is the crazy game of poker really the game of life?
There you go.
Is that what this song is telling us?
There you go.
I think it might be, yeah. Because certainly things get crazy, well after the poker has wrapped up.
Yeah.
And in fact, the craziest stuff seems to be happening outside of the poker game.
Right.
And then we return to, I think, a different poker game.
Yeah.
And it's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, if there's a point, a theme, a meaning that we're coming to, I think it just might be, you got to throw it all down and kiss it goodbye.
Ooh, I like that. Okay, let's see. Thanks to everyone who has submitted story songs. We have one more day. We'll have one more listener pick and another pick that I will make, and then the crowning Steve Hawkinsmith story song pick. All right, let's get out of here. Thanks very much for listening. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I am Steve Hawkinsmith.
Talk to y'all later. Oh, now, of course, another famous song about gambling would advise you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them, right?
Yes.
And that's life, of course, is what they're really talking about on that train bound to nowhere.